Live from the Talking Joe Studios, it's Talking Joe.
G.I. Joe, the very best, America's elite. Eliter than all the rest, trained to have no flaws. Defending liberty across the land, valor oversized. Bring out that big brass band, real heroes verified.
G.I. Joe!
Gotta read them all, you must agree. Elitist in history,
G.I. Joe.
Oh, there could be no end in a world we must defend.
G.I. Joe,
gotta read them. A courageous crew, their colors red, whites, and blue. Mess with them and they'll shoot you. G.I. Joe, gotta read them all. Gotta read them all.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, everybody's favourite dedicated G.I. Joe comics podcast. If you are new to the show, you can find out all of the details at the website, which is talkingjoe.co.uk. We are continuing our look at the disavowed era of G.I. Joe with this Special Missions issue, Special Missions Tokyo, from Devil's Due, September 2006. If you're reading along, it's collected in G.I. Joe America's Elite Special Missions Trade Paperback, which was released in March 2007. That collected Manhattan, Tokyo, and Antarctica Special Missions. And talking to me about this issue is everyone's favourite co-host. It's a real American Tim. It's Tim Finn.
Hello, Mark, and hello, listeners.
Hey there, listeners. It's Tim, it's Mark, and we're going to talk Special Missions Tokyo. Let's start by looking at the front of the book in one of them things that they call a cover.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
All right, so the cover is drawn by Tim Seeley, and help me out. Who's the colorist? It's signed Cliff.
Cliff Rathburn.
Oh, Cliff Rathburn colored a bunch of Invincible at
yeah,
Skybound.
Yeah, I thought I recognized his name.
And on that book is doing a very flat style, and on this G.I. Joe cover is rendering like it's 2005. All right, so whereas the previous G.I. Joe Special Missions issue from Devil's Due had a lot of copy on the front cover, this one does not... Well, I guess it still has the logo. It still says Special Missions. This time it says Tokyo instead of Manhattan. And it does say two stories, 48 pages, nonstop action. But sort of overall, it feels less busy because not all that stuff is at the top.
They've moved it to the bottom of the page. And they've also got rid of the list of creators from the front cover.
Yes. All right. So this cover is a bit of a montage cover where Jinx is front and center. Behind her on the right, much larger, looking at us, is Budo, head and shoulders, in his proper action figure costume, right? Not his Devil's Due sort of master and apprentice infiltration, just wearing black or just wearing gray, but his samurai helmet and his samurai armor. And behind him, some neon signage, because Tokyo, and... I think I see the G.I. Joe logo in Japanese. That's the thing in blue.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think it might be... Oh, I think we're seeing the part of it that says Joe, not the part of it that says G.I., which would be covered by his collar and his neck. And then on the left half of the cover, in the background, an orange-red sky with a sun coming up over Mount Fuji in the distance, but the sun is also... got sort of bands of light coming out of it, so it looks like the Imperial Japanese flag, right, which is not the red circle, but the red circle with the lines coming out of it from the 40s, although here it's yellow on this red sky. Some buildings lit up because it's Tokyo, and then below, Clutch and Gung Ho and Rock and Roll coming at ya with some ground and some sort of nondescript, you know, greenish sky behind them. So these, you know, five or six elements of the cover where these characters aren't all necessarily in the same space as each other, but, you know, the way that modern movie posters will montage, you know, a couple heads and some full bodies and one car and a little, you know, smidge of background. Fun, surprisingly, just in front of Gung-Ho's fist is not just the Devil's Due logo, but a five-year anniversary Devil's Due logo. And in a previous episode, we had referred to the fact that we were 5 years in Devil's Due, you know, their first comic for G.I. Joe published in September of 2001, and also a final page or an inside back cover of a then recent issue or then imminent issue, which was sort of a letter signed from all the Devil's Due staff, like, thanks for supporting us for 5 years. And so now it actually gets some cover recognition. I have commented before about how Seeley draws pretty well. I find his art lacks a lot of pep and heft. His characters sometimes feel sort of light and sort of stiff in their posing, and that's what I'm seeing here in Jinx. I see her sort of in the air, but I don't quite understand what the emphasis of her jump is, sort of where the tension is in her like torso or legs. You know, Gung-Ho, it's sort of the same thing. He's sort of running, but I sort of see it, but I don't feel it. I do very much appreciate that Budo is in his actual samurai costume, because I think there are some, I don't know, writers, artists, editors, fans who think that it's sort of embarrassing if Budo shows up in a proper G.I. Joe versus Cobra story wearing a ceremonial samurai armor. And I think that's silly too, but I want to see him in that costume because that's what his action figure is. You know, I don't want to see, you know, Gung-Ho in like wearing the same thing as Snow Job in a snow mission. Like, it's silly that Gung-Ho would be wearing a sleeveless vest in the Arctic, but that's his costume and I want him to be wearing that. So, and overall this cover, you know, it grabs you. It's an okay cover that attempts to be exciting.
Mm.
And there were no variant covers for this issue.
No, which is a nice change. Hooray.
Oh, there is a second colorist credited for the cover, right? That I wasn't looking. The inside front cover says the cover is by Tim Seeley, Cliff Rathburn, and Brian Bussolato. And Cliff Rathburn is a color artist and I think did all the gray tones for The Walking Dead. And Brian Bussolato is a color artist. So I don't know how the work got divided for this cover, but interesting.
Okay, so the lead story, Special Missions Tokyo, is from writer Rob Rohde.
Robert Rohde, the writer of the lead story in Special Missions Tokyo. This is his first G.I. Joe work, and he had written comics before this. He wrote a Marvel miniseries called Identity Disc. He wrote some Loki and Thor miniseries. I guess one of them is before this, and a couple of them come after this, or are published after this. I was first aware of him in comics. He did a Vertigo series around 2001 called Codename Knockout. But before that, he'd written a bunch of novels. I guess he has been writing novels also recently. And he's also a singer. He sings jazz, cabaret, and spoken word. And he has a trio or a band. So he's a performer. You can see him live. And that's interesting to me in that, you know, Larry Hama's a singer, plays guitar, plays in a blues rock band. I mean, it used to, hasn't recently. But, you know, we have pointed out when we're covering who's writing and drawing these stories, where someone sort of comes from a very different place, or, you know, maybe what else they've done in comics.
Okay, getting back to the credits. Penciler, Tim Seeley. Inker, Robert Q. Atkins. Interesting, Robert Atkins inking this one. I thought that Tim Seeley's work was looking good, and maybe it's the addition of Robert as an inker here. Anyway, distraction aside, colorist Jean-François Beaulieu, letterer Brian J. Crowley, editor Mike O'Sullivan.
Plot breakdown.
Budo has gone missing after breaking up with Jinx. Jinx goes looking to find him with the help of Wild Bill, Clutch, Rock and Roll, and Gung Ho. She discovers Budo as he appears to have become a turncoat against the Joes, but in the end, he reveals that he has been working undercover, and between them, they save the day, and Budo is reunited with Jinx. It's high stakes in this story. They're sort of stopping a full-on Japanese coup, aren't they?
Yeah. So this refers back to some things that we have seen in Master and Apprentice, mm-hmm. Master and Apprentice 2, where Jinx and Budo have a relationship,
yep.
and they're both out of the Joe team, or he's really out of the Joe team, and she's kind of out of the Joe team. But like the previous Special Missions issue, this issue also goes to some lengths to bring in some favorite characters who aren't the marquee 5 or 10 Joes. And, you know, it's not just Clutch or Rock and Roll. It's Clutch and Rock and Roll, who had been a pair in the Marvel run. They have a little adventure around, issue 35? And they have a little adventure around issue 88, 89. And maybe again after that, I forget. And Wild Bill gets to do something besides just fly a C-130.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Marvel Comics, or fly a dragonfly, Sunbow Marvel cartoons. And this issue is very much playing with the idea that in Japan, there is a certain philosophy, both in terms of sort of cultural and national pride, but also Bushido, like, you know, the code of Bushido, which Jinx and Budo talk about, and also that you have Japanese people and you have outsiders. And both in the scene where Colton and Sparks are trying to figure out who can go on this mission, you know, there's this moment where it's played as a joke where Sparks says, well, these two guys could go on the mission. And, you know, Colton says, haven't we got any more reserves who are more ... diplomatically inclined? Because, you know, Clutch is a chauvinist, as I recall from his original file card, and Rock and Roll is, I don't know, brash or something, or loud. And then Sparks in the final panel of this page says, only other Joes in the area are these. And Colton slaps his forehead and says, good grief. And then you turn the next page and Gung Ho and Wild Bill are showing up and getting hugged by Clutch and Rock and Roll. And I like this. I feel like it's, and then the dialogue continues on to this next page from Colton saying, that's like adding cayenne to Tabasco sauce. And I like this. I feel like this is overplaying it. Like, you know, these four Joes, they're not like a bull in a china shop. Like, they're not going to embarrass America or the American military or G.I. Joe. You know, it's a little hard because when Larry Hama is writing these file cards in the 80s, he's got to make these characters distinct so that when you're looking at the toy package at the toy store, you think, oh man, this guy's great, or this is so funny, or this guy's so cool, I got to buy this. And then when you play with the toys, you've got some fuel. And also then when he writes the comics, he's got some fuel. But, you know, if you think about how G.I. Joe would actually work, you know, if someone was, you know, if they're like the best saboteur or like sniper in the universe, but they like burp a lot and like curse and litter and, I don't know, like hit on someone else on the team inappropriately, you might kick them off the team. And so you're not going to have these Joes that are so gregarious or rude. So I feel like this little scene with Sparks and Colton, with, you know, and Colton slapping his forehead, a little overdone.
Yeah, they put it quite on the nose in the data desk handbook entries for Clutch later on. I don't know if you read this all the way through, but he said the main drawback to Clutch is his brash demeanor. He can have the worst hygiene, make the crudest comments, and forget tact at most times. He is not one for any situation requiring diplomacy or subtlety, and I generally would avoid pairing him with any female operative, as his behavior towards women tends to be archaic. However, when you get past this surface personality, who find a quality man that has a huge heart for others. It's a shame that he chooses to keep most of these attributes internally buried most of the time.
And the only sentence in his original file card from 82, right, it's the third person quote from someone else at the bottom. He greases his hair with motor oil, rarely shaves, and chews on the same toothpick for months. Clutch still calls women chicks.
Right.
And so this is a reasonable expansion and extrapolation of that. But at the same time,
sitting here in 2023, as a manager, you know, if you've got someone who you can't trust in female company, you know, your HR policies would not be try and just put, you know, keep females away from them. It would be you don't want that person in your organization.
You send them to sensitivity training. But I don't like this bit where Colton slaps his forehead, because that's a joke that you and I can enjoy as readers at the expense of Clutch, a character who I like. We should note that this story starts in a similar format as the previous Special Missions story, where both the inside front cover has the data desk readout of the active Joes who are in the main book who are otherwise occupied, so they can't be in the story, which actually might be kind of a mean switcheroo. You know, you buy Special Missions Manhattan, you buy Special Missions Tokyo, and you flip it open, and on the inside front cover you see cool Duke and Roadblock and Snake Eyes, and then you read the story and you're like, wait, where are they? And also, both stories start with Sparks and Colton at a computer figuring out who is available. And so that makes me wonder if for the following, are there three or four more Special Missions specials? Will this be the format for all of them?
There's a total of five: Manhattan, Tokyo, Antarctica, Brazil, and The Enemy.
Thank you. The other thing that immediately jumps out to me about this story is, one, Seeley's work looks great for having Robert Atkins ink him. I also noticed in the credits, Robert Q. Atkins, why, he's penciled many issues of G.I. Joe, written by Chuck Dixon long after this comic, and also Larry Hama long after those comics, and also did something for Snake Eyes Declassified,
yeah.
And he's a great addition to Tim Seeley. But also, I very much note the coloring in this story by Jean-Francois Beaulieu, who I know as a colorist who has colored a lot of comics by Scotty Young. All those Oz comics that Scotty Young did for Marvel, and I think a bunch of other stuff. And the coloring in this story, it looks like cell shading. It looks like how the Dreamwave Transformers comics, I don't mean penciled backgrounds that are then painted, but I mean characters and props, like on the first page, you know, like everything has two colors. Jinx's face, the doorman's coat, I guess the taxi behind her has three colors because it's metallic, but everything has sort of a base color and a shade color, just like a lot of animation cells. And it's a really good look for G.I. Joe, for Tim Seeley, for a story that's set in Japan. And then something interesting happens on page two of the story, where Jinx enters her apartment, and in the scene, one, two, three, four times, is drawn a flashback of Jinx and Budo talking or arguing, and they are drawn or colored or printed as translucent, as transparent. So they sort of look like ghosts, and you can sort of see the background through them. And this is to say, these are her memories in this actual place. Like, they must have been talking right there by the table or right there by the couch. And similarly, their word balloons in these flashbacks are also somewhat transparent. And that's a really neat device, and it's well done. And there's a small bit of sort of acting, writing, storytelling on this second page where Jinx is wiping the dust with her finger off of a table. And it doesn't, there's no good follow through, because the next panels you need to have her looking at her finger to examine how much dust. And instead, in the next panel, You have a very stiff Tim Seeley pose of Jinx sitting and not at all relaxing on her couch. That's not how people sit on couches. But
maybe she's feeling uncomfortable. Maybe. Anyway, but you know, to sort of, you know, put a real pin in that, I think Tim Seeley's art in this issue looks just about as good as we've ever seen it. I think Robert Atkins' inks brings a lot to it. I imagine that he's not just going over the top of Seeley's lines, but he's sort of changing things up, adding some detail here and there, and all the rest of it. And the colors are really sympathetic and really well handled. You don't get any of that crazy kind of computer gradiency or sort of the glowing clothes. You know, the coloring is sort of got that sort of fairly flat cell shading, and you know, particularly in like this early scene, you can clearly see it. He's got a very clear understanding of how light works as the light is sort of coming through into this apartment, with a dark apartment with some light just coming through one particular window. So it looks really good.
Yeah, and it makes me sort of hopeful and sad at the same time that all of the previous Seeley art might have had this finish. You know, maybe future Seeley art will have this finish. So she gets this DVD in the mail, and it's a video from Budo, and this page, I guess it's page 4, there's a lot of dialogue, and I started to feel like, oh, is this going to be a factor in these Special Missions comics where a writer who hasn't written a lot of G.I. Joe before is sort of trying to juggle the demands of a G.I. Joe story, but also including, because it's Special Missions, some characters who we haven't seen in a while. So you have to sort of say what they've been up to or what they're going to do that's so interesting to bring them back. And the same way that the there's a moment or two in Special Missions Manhattan where all of a sudden there's a lot of talking. I get to this page and I think, okay, this is complicated enough that I do need Budo to explain it to me as he's explaining it to Jinx. And there is a nice cut here. I'm going to use a film term, not a comic book term. There's a nice cut here on page 4 where the video goes from Budo on the screen and Jinx is watching it to Budo finishes, and then the camera pulls back, and it's Colton and Sparks who are watching it, and then Colton makes the point that they got the video from Jinx, and so time has passed since she handed it off to them, and time had passed since she had actually received it since Budo had sent it. So, okay, in terms of sort of the sort of film directing of this page, I like it. There's a good edit there. But in terms of the writing, you know, I'm just thinking of how a scene like this might happen in a G.I. Joe comic by a different writer, where maybe the Joes would be on a plane flying somewhere and someone is explaining what they're going to be doing. Like, okay, there's this guy in Japan and he's trying to make weapons and he's named himself after this other organization and something's going to happen and we think it's going to happen on this date. And it would be more incorporated into sort of the Joes gearing up, like, make sure you bring your extra ammo because this guy we're going after, who's a weapons supplier in Japan, he's going to have a lot of ammo. Something like that, as opposed to 4 panels of info dump.
Yeah, there's way too much from Budo on this page. And mentally I was looking at, ugh, that is too much. Skim read it. I'm sure I'll figure it out. So I don't think I even read all of his the detail of his dialogue. It was you know, completely off-putting.
And then you turn the page, and there's this huge dialogue conversation between Colton and Sparks.
And I think really that just needs an editorial pass. It's like way too much. You can probably convey everything you need to know without changing very much at all, with maybe a third of the dialogue.
All right, so the two other Joes and the two other Joes show up. Something that Seeley does, which I like, and it's very much on display on page 6. At the bottom of page 6, Gung-Ho's walking next to Wild Bill, and Gung-Ho is taller and wider than Wild Bill. And there are some Joe artists who draw every Joe the sort of the same height and same build. And some of the big guys, like Roadblock and Gung-Ho, are definitely not. You know, it's like when you draw Cable in X-Men comics. Like, no, Cable's taller and bigger than everyone, you know? Like, Cyclops is taller and skinnier than everyone, because remember his nickname in the 60s was Slim. and so, as hard as I am on Seeley, this is something that he does that I really appreciate.
And that panel also does something that is definitely a Seeleyism, which is backs to the audience. He does like having his character sort of walking away with their backs to the audience. So it's good to see a repeat of that.
This Clutch costume, Clutch's original figure is, it's all green with some business on his front torso. And then in 84, it's recolored and he comes with the Vamp Mark II, right? And then version 3 of Clutch is the Mega Marine, which is just bananas.
oranges more. Pick a different fruit.
I dislike it so much that I love it. And
it's gone all the way around the scale and back.
But also, it's like, it's not him anymore because he doesn't have facial hair. You know, it's like, I think at this point, they're trying to make the figure look like the comic where he's got a, like, he hasn't shaved for 4 days, or the show. Anyway, I think you need to keep facial hair consistent. Anyway, the Devil's Due costume, it's okay. It's to me, it's missing something. It needs one more thing, and I don't love it. I think part of what I'm reacting to is I don't love it when a Joe has sort of one color and that's it. Like in this case, Clutch has a beige hat, a beige shirt, and beige pants. And there are some tiny differences because, you know, he's got like a brown belt and brown gloves and a brown bandolier and brown boots or something. But if you squint, he's one thing, he's beige. And I sort of reserve that for icons like Storm Shadow or Stalker or, to some extent, Cobra Commander, you know, all blue. Or, am I about to disprove my own point? Or the 1982 Joes. Green guy. And I guess Clutch is a green guy. Well, anyway, I'd like one more thing in his costume. All right, so then we get into the actual business of how Jinx is going to have these four Joes help her. And the story gets into this theme of turning a weakness into a, what's the word? Strongness.
Strength. Strength.
Thanks. Another thing that I appreciate about Tim Seeley is that when he draws Jinx and Budo and this Japanese guy, Hayato Toba, they look Japanese, right? He gets their eyes right. And this is something that a lot of comics artists don't quite get. All right, now that we've gotten past sort of the bull in the china shop's joke of these four Joes and this sort of backstory with this relationship and too much dialogue on a couple of pages, now we get into the actual story of how Jinx and the four Joes are going to do this thing. So, Mark, take it away. How do you feel?
So essentially, they dress up in outfits. They've arranged an appointment with this former politician who's doing this arms dealing, and they, you know, worm their way in. But it's a couple of things that sort of I don't like quite so much in it, which is the Joes without a plan. They're sort of like, we'll get in there and figure things out. And again, sort of best of the best, they should have some sort of plan. But the sort of the broader theme about the story is that, you know, it's that thing again where Budo, he's split up with Jinx to go off, do his lone wolf thing, pretend that he's turned when he's still sort of, you know, on the side of the good guys, but he's just deep undercover. But, you know, really, do you need to go to that extreme of you know, splitting up with your long-term partner to just go on a mission like that? It you know, seems a little bit immature, but really, you know, you should, particularly when she comes and, you know, essentially rescues him at the end of it as well. If he'd just brought her along, you know, with the story, she could have supported and understood rather than been sidelined and catching up at the end. But yeah, they sort of seem to sort of luck into a way around and coming up trumps at the end of the story.
The scene where the four Joes play the American business people and what's the Japanese guy's name? Toba, Hayato Toba. And he's, you know, trying to get them to leave, and he asks his secretary to have them leave, and then he calls security. This whole scene where the four Joes are pretending to be American business people and they're in civilian clothes and they're sort of, and they're fake arguing with each other. This is when I realized this works for me if this is an episode of the cartoon from 1985 or 1986, particularly when the Joes use their real names.
Yeah. It's like Master of Disguise James Bonds, you know.
Yeah. So
why are you using your real names?
Yeah. So, you know, Clutch and Rock and Roll come in and the secretary says, "Oh, I think your 3 o'clock is here early." And Clutch says, "Lance Steinberg, Mr. Toba. And this is my eight partner," corrects Rock and Roll, "Craig O'Connell. I assume you've heard of us." And it's not even sort of a cute joke where, you know, author Robert Rohde takes Clutch's real name and like changes one syllable or one letter, or like flips the first name and last name, or like makes it a something that sounds like it. No, it's just their real names. And I think there's only one episode of the Sunbow Marvel cartoon, maybe two. I think there's only one where, okay, yeah, one's a two-parter, so I think, Red Rocket's Glare. All right, I think there are only four episodes. So Roadblock Marvin, Dusty, and then the episode where Lady J gets invited to Destro's castle, and there's an actual mail call for the Joes, and they get mail, and someone says, "Who's this?" And someone's like, "That's me," because they don't all know their real names. Anyway, even the cartoon didn't have them use their real names out in the world, because aren't they all top secret? Doesn't the Pentagon have their papers in a safe or something? So cute, but a little distracting. And I think a G.I. Joe comic book story can be lighter. It doesn't have to be always gritty. And the stakes can be, you know, there can be mild stakes and medium stakes and heavy stakes. And
okay, now I feel hungry.
I think what's throwing me off about this story is that this Japanese businessman who's a weapons dealer or a sort of a conspiracist is going to, so he invades Tokyo with all this armament and this army that he's been quietly building up. And the Joes are like being a little humorous in his office. And also then a sort of recently, not a long lost, but a recently lost Cobra agent shows up in the story. And I think a G.I. Joe story can juggle all of these. And I did like the story while I read it, but I don't know if it all works.
Yeah. Yeah, there's elements that may be a little bit clunkier than others. And it's doing quite a lot of storytelling in terms of raising the stakes and then bringing them down again very rapidly. So they're doing quite a lot within the spaces of like a few pages, sort of wrapping up the story again at the end of it. And G.I. Joe's role in how they all gets resolved isn't entirely clear. They do some punching at the end, but I don't, you know, that doesn't sort of stop, you know, change the hearts and minds of the Japanese insurrectionists.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk down those tanks, whatever. That sort of kind of gets a little bit glossed over, that it seems like Budo is somehow able to have spoken with people and sort of, you know, got them to change their minds about trying to overthrow the government after all of that investment of time and energy.
Yeah. Okay. And then here's a really great thing that Seeley does and a not so great thing that Seeley does on page. I think it's page 22. The page where the top panel is Armada, and she's saying, "Budo, why would I need to? Where is he?" And it's sort of yellow orangey. When the Joes start punching on the bottom panel, Gung-Ho is smashing a face into one of these sort of Japanese, like, stormtrooper televipers, Iron Grenadiers, and that feels like the cartoon, not the comic. But move your eye a couple inches to the right and look at Jinx's pose. Look at this awesome pose that Tim Seeley has put her in for this kick. I don't know if that's, she's planting one hand and then her legs are up. I don't know if that's a realistic fighting pose, but that's a cool drawing. But then on the next page, Armada is about to shoot Jinx, and some weird, like, triangular purse or satchel, like, comes into the panel and is touching her neck.
It's the butt of a gun knocking her out.
Is it? Okay, yeah. I feel like
it's
the butt of a gun.
It's a rifle butt.
I feel like we need to see more of it in order for it to read. Because just the way that it's cropped and the way that her earpiece is sort of flying off but straight up and down, it's not, like, arcing or... Anyway, I got to that panel and I thought, she says, "You're still outnumbered. And I thought, oh, is like time slowing down for this one panel? Like, no, Mark, there's no way. So I guess one of these televiper, stormtrooper, Iron Grenadiers is behind her holding a weapon, but you can't see the butt in the next panel. So it's not clear to me that.
Yeah,
that's the rifle that was used.
It's less obvious. It's less obvious that that's the thing that he's holding is the type of rifle that would have a butt that you can conk over the someone's head. It's a bit dark, and his weapon is a bit sort of hidden by his
arm
where he's carrying it. Yeah.
Okay, so then you turn the page and there's this outdoor scene and the Joes have run outside and there is a full on tank invasion insurrection of Tokyo. And it's not just one little part of Tokyo, because there are two explosions, boom, boom, in the distance behind other buildings, right? And people are running and screaming, and Jinx says, "Oh my god!" And Gung-Ho says, "This is not good!" And then Clutch says, "Holy cats, where do we even start?" At this point, I thought, how many pages does this story have to wrap up? And then you turn the page, and it's like, well, we're going to punch our way out. And I thought, okay, I think this story needs to reconcile its different sort of tones or aspects. And you know, like, you think of certain action movies where the stakes are really high, like some villain is going to actually destroy the world. But, you know, the hero's, like, joking and they, like, sort of skipping along and, like, they're not worried. They never feel like they're in danger. And I think I prefer movies where the hero or the hero team, you know, like Mission Impossible or, you know, Batman or Fast and the Furious, whatever it is. Like, I can know that they're all going to be okay. And maybe one of them can be sort of cocky, but I feel like when all of them are like, we're going to get through this, we have no worry that there's any real sense of danger. That really diminishes the sense of danger that the rest of the movie, or in this case, the rest of the comic, is trying to set up. So,
Rock and Roll says, "Gotta make do with Mama Fist and her four baby knuckles."
I mean, that's a good line. Oh, Rock and Roll doing some Chuckles cosplay.
Yeah,
I hadn't noticed.
And this sort of the quick resolution of that issue is sort of conveyed in Wild Bill's dialogue towards the end. He says, "So hang on a minute here. You're saying you had the whole situation in hand, and we rode in and almost ruined it for you." "No, not at all. You managed to offer just enough resistance to enable my men to take advantage of the confusion and quell the rebellion. Ask me no more details of how we did that." something, you know. It was, well, we were able to get into some helicopters and something, enemy was defeated.
Yeah, on the second to last page, this is the one where there's a lot of green tones and Budo shows up. On the third to last page, Budo shows up in a helicopter in his full costume. And then on the second to last page, there's a lot of dialogue. And I thought, I don't know if this is the proper balance for a G.I. Joe special mission story where there's this info dump at the beginning on pages, I think it's 3 and 4. And there's sort of this like, well, let me explain it to you, info dump on the second to last page. I like all of the separate elements here. I like that, you know, Clutch flirts with someone on the last page and makes a reference to sticking around and trying to flirt some more. And I like that Voodoo and Jinx are back together. And I like that, you know, this army weapons plot did have a Cobra connection. I don't know if how all these things tie together work for me.
You move on to the next thing.
Yeah. Then there's a data desk profile of Budo and Jinx.
Indeed.
Okay. So then keep going.
Plus rock and roll.
Oh, right. Wild Bill. Right. Yeah, there are five more pages.
And then we're into the second story, Juliet, from writer-editor Mike O'Sullivan, penciler Mike Bear, who goes on to do some more G.I. Joe penciling later on in the America's Elite series. Inker John Lowe, colorist Rob Ruffalo, and letterer Brian J. Crowley, with thanks to Phil Kost, who must have provided some of that military advisor stuff.
So not only does Mike Bear go on to pencil G.I. Joe soon after this, okay, Rob Ruffalo colors a bunch of, I think colors and then draws a bunch of Transformers at Dreamwave, right around here. Anyway, please continue.
So this story summary, Sparks has been on the hunt for the missing Joes that Major Blood has claimed to have killed in issue 19.
In a story we haven't read yet.
We will have at this point when we drop this. Is it issue 9?
Issue 9.
Okay. I'll start that again. Spark has been on the hunt for the missing Joe that Major Blood has claimed to have killed back in issue 9. The last remaining Joe unaccounted for is Recondo. Being old friends, he goes to visit Sierra Gordo, the last known place Recondo was seen alive, to discover if it is true. After speaking to the Turico and seeing the memorial that they have created for Recondo, he can't help but conclude that Recondo is dead, killed by Major Blood. That is until he gets a top secret message via email from Recondo at the end, saying that he is only pretending to be dead and they will see each other again. So an interesting story. It's putting Sparks in a headline role. It's mostly conveyed via caption boxes as he's recalling his trip to Sierra Gordo, and it features in large part a couple of fan favorites: Major Blood, the villainous Cobra, with his metallic hand having been chopped off in an earlier story, and Recondo back in his adopted home of Sierra Gordo.
So this is a fascinating structure where in the main book, Blood says, I've killed a Joe, and we don't know who it is. Mm-hmm. And then a Joe or the Joes sort of figure out mostly who it isn't. And then this story picks up that thread. And in the main book, if it's issue 9, that's still Joe Casey, right? Yep. So here you have a writer who's not Joe Casey picking up a thread from a Joe Casey story and telling a story about this missing Joe. Something else that's interesting that happens here, right? So your big point is that Sparks gets this lead role, and we've only ever seen him in Marvel Sunbow episodes, 4 of them, and Devil's Due Comics, sitting at a desk in front of a screen telling someone what's on the screen. And here he goes to another country and he's investigating and he's impassioned on this mission and sad. The other interesting thing that happens here is visually on the third page as he's narrating. So the story starts with us seeing the fist fight to the death between Recondo and Blood. And then the story transitions on the third page where Sparks is narrating. I have no doubt that he set out after Blood in his own time, hoping to accomplish individually what the team, the Joes, hadn't. And then across the next few panels, Sparks fades in. All signs point to something going awry. And the silhouettes of Rakondo and Major Blood fighting that Sparks sees fade out. And this is kind of a filmic device where we are seeing something that happened in the past, and then we are seeing someone in the present imagine it in its place in front of them. And that's a really cool, I don't want to say trick because it's not a trick, device. That's a really cool device. That's done well here, both visually and the interplay between words and pictures.
And funnily enough, it's not too dissimilar a device to the one that Jinx had when she went back to the apartment in the first story and was imagining the kind of the ghosts of the past of her and Budo together in that apartment.
Right, right. And yet Robert Roddy wrote R-O-D-I, I don't know if it's Roddy or Roddy, Robert Roddy, writes the lead story, and Mike O'Sullivan writes the backup story. But the lead story, who edits the lead story? Is that Mike O'Sullivan? Anyway.
Yeah, it would be Mike O'Sullivan.
So this story is very concerned with making Sparks into a character and, you know, what he likes, what he's interested in, what he wants to do. And the fact that him doing this thing, going on this mission, is so different for him. And sort of the idea that only he can do this. And also making Rakondo into a character. And so there's this page of flashback panels where in narration, Sparks is explaining to us, the reader, sort of who Rakondo was and how they became friends and sort of how they were as friends. There is one moment of narration that doesn't work for me, and that's a couple pages later where it's the page before the one where Rakondo falls off the cliff, where the chief of the village is sort of pointing out something to Sparks, and then we see in the sort of flashback panel below it, Blood punches Rakondo, and in the narration, and neither one gaining an upper hand in the struggle until, as expected, and then in the next panel, Blood is back handedly punching Rakondo in the face. Blood fought dirty. And that line really stuck out to me. It's like, wait, Blood? Major Blood? A mercenary who often works for a global terrorist organization? Like, even pointing out that he's fighting dirty seems like putting a weird set of kid gloves on this. Like, I understand that it's as expected he fought dirty, but like, no, this guy kills people. Like, you hire him and he leads armies and he kills people and he's trying to kill Rakondo. I fully expect him to fight dirty, to like try to poke Rakondo's eyes and kick him in the balls. And like, yes, use his cyborg hand. Like, what? Like, come on. Just change those three words. You know, like, until, as expected, he had the upper hand, you know, or he used his secret weapon. Like, he fought dirty? Like, Cobra only fights dirty. They're terrorists.
And also, you know, and also just punching him with his special robot hand doesn't seem that dirty, really.
Right. I feel like in movies, because I have not been in this kind of fight, I feel like in movies and in comics, when someone's fighting dirty, it's like the two of you are squaring off and someone grabs sand or dust from the ground, and instead of throwing a punch, throws dirt in your eyes. Or like, I don't know, like, grabs a knife and stabs you in the boot and then like kicks you and you fall over, but your boot's stuck to the ground. Something, I don't know.
Yeah.
So this scene is sort of building up anticipation that Blood is going to push him over the, I guess you don't know it's a cliff yet, but you might sort of guess. But Blood walks toward him and then has a knife. And I thought, oh, I don't like this, right? Like, you know, I've no doubt that a cheap shot from Blood's bionic hand would break bones and cause much damage, leaving Rakondo dazed, disoriented, most likely concussed, and completely vulnerable. And it's starting to feel now, what's the word? Gratuitous? Like Mike O'Sullivan, yes, he's trying to get us to be sympathetic to Sparks' pain for losing a friend and build up our worry for Rakondo. But it also feels like, I don't think Mike O'Sullivan is enjoying this, but I feel like it's stretched out a little bit too much. Like, Like there's this sort of unseen narrator who's like nudging me. It's like, oh man, Ricondo's sure gonna get it. Oh man, oh, look out, Ricondo. And I don't like it when main characters are killed. You know, I think generally Joes shouldn't die in stories. And for the next couple pages, I thought this had really happened to Ricondo. Spoiler. And so I had a second problem with this page, which is like, all right, just get on with it. And then, you know, you turn the page and he's getting stabbed. And it's like, no, just take that dialogue out. Like, just have him walk up. Take that narration. Just have him walk up, stab him, kick him off the cliff. Like, that's plenty. Like, that sucks. Like, oh, man. Like, Ricondo. I like Ricondo.
Yeah. Yeah. I think verbatim, that was pretty much my reaction. It's like, oh, man, Ricondo. Oh, I like Ricondo. You know, it's that's, you know, that's all I can think of saying. And that's all, you know, I very much believed that they were killing him in this story, in these pages. I'm like, oh man, that sucks. Ricondo's cool. Why do you have to kill Ricondo? So actually, you know, turning then the page and seeing that email from Ricondo sort of did make me breathe a bit of a sigh of relief. Like, oh, phew. Somehow he survived, and he's just laying low, thinking that thinking that he's dead would give him an advantage.
So then I wonder, jumping to this very end of the story, this message from Ricondo to Sparks back at base, saying, "I'm actually alive." You know, Ricondo says, "Sorry to leave you in the dark. Keep this between us. Consider me G.I. Joe's secret weapon." That's cool. Also, and all of the Joes are the best of the best, but does it feel like in that sentence, sort of, writer Mike O'Sullivan might be saying, well, Ricondo's my favorite Joe, and I am now elevating him to the top echelon of Joes. I mean, you know, Ricondo he's as good at this stuff as, you know, Rock and Roll and Rampart and Stalker, although because like Stalker, Snake Eyes, Roadblock, you know, show up in so many stories and are more popular, you start to maybe think, consciously or not, that they're, you know, better. And, you know, Ricondo is definitely the best jungle trooper on the Joe team, and he's as good as the rest of them at many, many things. Since he has been in few stories, I love his appearance in the episode Funhouse, by the way, the 1985 episode Funhouse. That line, you know, like, think of me as G.I. Joe's secret weapon, feels slightly overstated, but I understand the sentiment. And doesn't Mike O'Sullivan, he either keeps editing G.I. Joe or he starts writing G.I. Joe soon. And so he's either planting a seed that he hopes someone will use, or he's planting a seed that maybe he'll get to use. So that's cool. There is a little bit of Joes calling each other by their first name here, which I feel like in a previous episode, in this episode, when the Joes are in Tokyo, in a previous story, about 10 pages earlier. I mean, sure, a Joe can call another Joe by their first name out loud to themselves in the base, but you know, Ricondo emails Sparks and Ricondo signs it off as Alex. Oh, no. Sorry. He's calling Sparks Alex, right? Be well, Alex. It's like, no, just assume every email is getting hacked by Cobra. Like, don't let them know who you are. And then in the final panel, Sparks sits back in his chair and says, there you go, Dan. The stage is set. The next act is yours. It's like, you know, I guess the Devils Do Run has been doing this where, you know, Flint published a book, and the Joes use their first names sometimes. But I prefer that they don't.
I spy with my little eye.
Is this an I spy? The Tukaros, this tribe that Ricondo is visiting, and we see the chief giving Sparks a tour of where the fist fight happened and showing Sparks Ricondo's burial site. We have seen the Tukaros before. in Marvel issues 102 through 105, drawn by Mark Bright in, what was that, 1990 or 1991? Do you remember that story where a bunch of the like the last page of an issue, one of the Joes is like, it's like, as soon as we get to the jungle or the forest, we'll be safe. We can lose them in the brush. Yeah. And you turn the page and it's all been clear cut.
Yeah. That's the one with the thunderclap on the front cover.
Oh, is it? Wait, no. The thunderclap is 92. I think the story I'm thinking of is about 10 issues later. But anyway, regardless, this tribe of people in Sierra Gordo we have met before. So Mike O'Sullivan is indirectly referring back to a Larry Hama story.
Yeah, I think the Tucuros are the sort of the key part of Recondo's story because, you know, Recondo hasn't had a huge amount of page time where he's been a real sort of focus character. So it was really that initial story where Recondo was first introduced along with the Tucuros where we really got to see very much of him at all. So it's kind of like the Tucuros and him, it's like the, because that's basically all that we've seen of him. It's like key to his backstory, key to his what we think of when we think of Recondo.
Right.
And of course, it was issue 38 where we first were introduced to Recondo with his first appearance, where he was in Sierra Gordo and had been sort of gone somewhat native with the Tucuros, and that's continued into issue 39, Walk Through the Jungle, where they're in Sierra Gordo, and the Tucuros are very integral into that story.
Yeah. All right, so overall, I think this this backup story with Sparks is good. There's that page in the middle with the flashback panels of Sparks and Recondo's friendship, which I, on the one hand, liked because it's a view of camaraderie and the G.I. Joe team sort of back at base that we don't see often. But on the other hand, it's many sentences of narration. Not so much I don't want to read it, but yeah, I don't know. I like that page. I also sort of wonder about that page. And then the story ends with this reveal that we've already described. And then there's one more page of data desk profiles, and it is Recondo, and this is a Tim Seeley drawing. And even though I don't want there to be a lot of these data desk profiles in G.I. Joe comics, this one has a nice button to the story that you just read, the previous page that you just read, because in this email that Sparks gets from Recondo, Recondo says, "Mark me deceased in the data desk and keep this between us. Consider me G.I. Joe's secret weapon." Then you turn the page and you see Recondo's data desk profile. And in the top section, after his name and his file number and his specialties, it says status deceased.
Indeed. So it's sort of almost continuing on that story into the data desk page. Should we give this a Yo-Joe-age score?
Yeah.
Yo-Jo cola, not grape soda.
It's Yo-Joe-age time.
Special Missions Tokyo. Five. It's okay.
I think I'll go maybe like 6.5 on this. The Tokyo one, it was, I enjoyed, I liked the art particularly, and it was pleasing to see Tim Seeley's pencils shining in the way that they did. But, you know, there were elements of the story that was problematic that we talked about in terms of the compression and the way that the story wrapped up and maybe overdoing some of the dialogue. The sort of backup story was interesting, but my responses to it a little bit mixed, but it did hit the feels in terms of me being worried that Recondo had been KIA. So yeah, there we go. It was good and certainly not a regrettable read. So I think that is us done with Special Missions Tokyo. Next time on Talking Joe Disavowed, we'll be continuing our look at the America's Elite era of G.I. Joe, and we'll be doing all sorts of other things along the way, as well as we get ever closer to the Skybound relaunch of G.I. Joe. So, Tim, where can people find you when you are not talking to me about G.I. Joe comics?
Video essays from my creative partners and I at our YouTube channel, Atomic Abe Productions. My brick-and-mortar comic book store in Somerville, Massachusetts is Hub Comics. And I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com.
Excellent stuff. You can find more about Talking Joe at the usual places. TalkingJoe.co.uk is the website that has links to all of those places. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. We are also on Patreon at patreon.com/TalkingJoe. So a big thanks to all our backers: Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, and Shane, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. And that is us done for now. But remember that
nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Laters.